Hello, and welcome to the Droids Outpost, a somewhat weekly podcast where we talk about things that are not Star Wars related, at least not directly. Here with Sam and Chris, I am Ryan. We are sadly missing Mike. He's off on an assignment for the Daily Bugle. So, today we are doing a spoiler... We're doing a spoiler-filled review of Spider-Man Far From Home. Boys, this came out last Tuesday.
Correct.
1 week ago. The day that this is being released, and it feels like it's been out for weeks.
That's true.
Well, and yeah, we should, Ryan, you just noted, this is a spoiler podcast. We have not gotten the official clearance from the Russo brothers on this one, but we are going to be talking in great detail about
beginning, middle, and ending of the movie. I guess it's a spoiler podcast for Endgame as well.
Oh, yeah, and all the other Marvel movies.
Tony's dead, everybody. Tony's... So,
wait, what?
He's a big dead dummy.
So where how are we going through this? Are we gonna go?
Well,
in
let's
order
start with
the...
initial. Let's start with initial impressions. I'll go first. Thank you asking. I loved it. We live in a golden age of Spider-Man movies. I do admit that I do have recency bias when it comes to Spider-Man movies. I think for every single one that's been released, I've said it's the best Spider-Man movie ever made, barring Spider-Man 3. I'm not doing that this time. I still think that Into the Spider-Verse is the best Spider-Man movie ever made. But
wait, would you include The Amazing Spider-Man 2 in that?
Like, when that movie came out, I said it was the best Spider-Man movie ever made, and I still uphold... that is a 2.5 hour movie, and I think that there is a very good 2 hour movie in it.
Okay.
Ooh, I don't think there's a good movie anywhere near that movie.
The suit's great.
Unless you're watching a different movie.
They made a mistake. They made a mistake casting them as the young people. Andrew Garfield would have been a great Peter Parker in his 20s.
I was watching
when he's
that,
like working for the Bugle.
I was watching a little bit of that. Not to go too tangent here. He has gray hairs in the second one on the side of his head. He has literal gray hairs. He's a stressed out.
Yeah, he should have been
playing stressed
out
high schooler.
24-year. He should have been playing like Amazing Spider-Man 2 should have been like the Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where he's like living in a ratty apartment and he's like delivering pizzas.
But it's all part of the Spider-Verse, baby.
Yeah. So he was great in the suit though. Anyway, I do think this is my favorite MCU Spider-Man movie. Well,
now,
there's only
kind of,
been two.
Are you saying
I like
two,
it better than
or
Homecoming?
Are you including
I will say
his
this.
Appearances and others?
I loved the movie. That's where I'm starting. I loved the movie, and a few, you know, almost a week has gone by now. It's still staying strong in my mind. So I think that I'm you know, not just riding the high of walking out of the theater. That everybody kind of does. Every single MCU movie has been the best MCU movie. And that's a cool thing. So, I really loved it. What did you guys think?
I think Far From Home, more like Feels Like Home, I loved it. no, I think it was great. I think,
and we'll pick that up again in 3, 2, 1.
Exactly. Far From
this
Home.
Is for, this
more
is
like,
for the
yeah,
back.
Yeah, this is when
this
they
is for the backseat of all the cabs.
Yeah, exactly. This is when they do it while you're in line for watching the movie, and then they like interview you after you come out.
Yeah, for the commercials. Where
yeah,
you're like,
exactly.
Man,
yeah.
It was great.
I did that for Super 8 once. They filmed me saying Super 8 is super great. no joke.
Is that true?
That is true. That is true.
Wow. Wow.
I really enjoyed it. I think that the first half, I think there's a couple halves of a movie here though. The first half I thought was perfect. It played upon all of the great strengths of the adolescence of Spider-Man and kind of the form factor we got from the first one. And then the second half turned into, I think once we found out who the bad guy was and how he was working, I think the solution was like a little too clear of how to solve the problem, but that could just be, I don't know. I feel like once we saw that was an illusion, it was like really hard to keep me motivated, but I still enjoyed all of the action. And I think visually it was like, for a Marvel movie, it was like stunning.
This is interesting. I would say I agree that there are two distinct like movies within this movie, two halves to this movie that are virtually different movies. And I loved the second half so much. It's not to say I didn't like the first half, but I think so. So you know, bird's eye view level thoughts. I really liked it, and I'll say that in the last week, like thinking about it, it's grown on me. But I think you know there are definitely MCU movies that I've come out with like a higher high than this one. What's interesting is like the first, so Spider-Man Homecoming was a movie that I loved every second of while I watched it. And the moment I stood up from my seat in the theater, I forgot about it entirely, and I've never rewatched it. And the first half of this movie, like, Chris, I agree, like, the first half of this movie is playing very much in that same sandbox. It is a direct sequel to that movie. Mm-hmm. And I have the same sort of feelings where it was like, I know I laughed a lot. I laughed a lot at Martin Starr and J.B. Yeah. Smoove. I, like, really, really liked certain scenes in the opening. And we'll go through a more detailed breakdown. But, like, it's water. I forgot about it. The second half, however, which I agree, it was very clear what the goal of, like, to do, how to fight the villain was. But I was very compelled by, like, Jake Gyllenhaal. Was great in this movie. We got more of him in the second half, I felt, or at least we got more of what I was interested in him in the second half. And so that second half is what I've been sort of enjoying on my revisit and remembering it. You know, but I'll stop there until we go through the sort of specific breakdowns.
Well, it's interesting because most of the people I've spoken to about the movie have similar feelings to what you guys are talking about, which is that there's kind of two halves to the movie and they either fall on enjoying one of them over the other. So I don't want to be misleading here and making it seem like I'm liking things in spite of or letting things go. I, like, legitimately both halves worked for me. So things that have been brought up as weaknesses of the movie by people that I've spoken to are, like, literally just things that I'm not looking past. They just literally worked for me. So it's an interesting thing because, you know, they have the first half where they're setting up Quentin Beck as kind of this, you know, Tony Stark-like figure to Peter, where he has this kind of, like, empty emotional hole that needs to be filled from Tony's death, and it's very affecting, and everybody's very charismatic, and that works very well. And to me, that worked. I found that compelling. You know, it being Mysterio, like, you know, we have this kind of sense that it's not, everything is not as it seems, and a lot has been spoken about in terms of the turn. You know, there's a specific scene in the bar where Peter leaves, and then we see it was all like an illusion.
Yeah,
and then Jake Gyllenhaal gives this like crooked smile that kind of sells the next 10 minutes.
Yep.
And there is this like very goofy quality to it. I like Jake Gyllenhaal a lot when he's in this like goofy space.
He's a funny guy.
And it sheds good light on the first half because the first half he's playing it like kind of so straight that you're like, this is like very earnest and like weird.
Yeah. I do.
And then it kind of explains itself. In a admittedly long bar scene.
I do like, that was a very complete scene. I do like that the Spider-Man movies in the MCU, they do bank on like their centerpiece is a twist of like epic proportions. And I think that's a lot of fun. I think the twist in this movie is great. I think what he's explaining it, how they've introduced clips from the past movies, I think that was a really great way to like tie it in to be like, see, he was here this whole time. Like this is all part of it. And like the way they aged Spider-Man up to now, like the timeline plays out.
It works really well. Like it plays into, and Ryan, you may have said, you may have incepted this idea into me, but it plays really well into the MCU's high school aged Spider-Man and his earnestness and his naivete and trustingness. Like he's not world weary, despite, I mean, obviously in the four or five movies Tom Holland's appeared in, he's seen a lot, but he's still a kid and he hasn't got to rip off Tony Stark. He doesn't have his armor up, you know, against other people.
He has actual like kid stakes, whereas I think in other Spider-Man movies Peter Parker's pretty much on his own. Like he doesn't have he has like that weird Disney Channel effect of like none of the kids really have parents that like monitor what they do. Like in this movie, like he's actually accountable by his aunt and Happy, like, and the school teachers and stuff. Like he still has to play to convention.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, it's interesting, and I understand why things don't work for people. Like I said, that Jake Gyllenhaal, the turn, it's like you kind of, he's kind of doing two performances, mm-hmm. and it's like people kind of like one or the other. I happen to like both, and I think that they kind of feed into each other interestingly. I mean, my wife has to forgive me. I've been doing this in the house for the last 3 days, but in the second half, I'm not going to say he's like doing a funny voice, but it is like literally one step away from like, well, geez, Spider-Man, you know, like it's like a very
yeah.
like,
yeah.
he's goofy. Like yeah. he's this kind of like sinister dude, but like it's, you know, it's tongue in cheek. And, mm-hmm. and I will say that I think that,
he's kind of one-sixth sinister, I'd say.
Very good. Very good. I think this is one of the better adaptations of a comic book villain that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, like, taking the ideas of a comic book villain and adapting them into something that makes sense for the world of the movie.
Yeah.
And kind of, like, a modernized thing. Obviously, like, Mysterio, I believe that the comic book origins is that he's like a special effects person that kind of like turns into a villain. And this is kind of the next step of that.
Sure.
With the holograms and the drones and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think that they did a beautiful job of establishing that and like enough that you're like, yes, I accept this.
Yeah,
exactly.
And you kind of accept the physics of it and the practicality of it all. And I think by doing that, one of my favorite lines in the movie is when Spider-Man's like, he's just some guy. Like, once I go past all this stuff, it's just a dude. Like, we can get him, no problem. I think by, like, lowering in the greater MCU picture, like, lowering the stakes or, like, making them a little more real, I think is, like, important. Because after a while, you're like, who can be worse than Thanos? Like, are we going to get introduced to this guy? Like, what's the greater threat? Mm-hmm. What's the greater threat? And I'm glad that they, like, they pegged it down and put it back to, like, on Peter's level, like, okay, here's an acceptable threat in a movie we can watch.
And there's a little bit of, like, a meta aspect to that, because Mysterio keeps saying, like, this needs to be an Avengers-level threat.
Right.
You know, like,
he literally
says that line.
Yeah.
And it's like, the Spider-Man movies have become the only MCU movies where, like, there's not a gun to the world's head
right.
at the end of it. Like, the stakes are not always so high. Yep. I mean, the stakes are pretty high in this, but it's not like, if we don't stop Mysterio, the entire world is going to explode.
Right.
Well, he's ultimately trying to ultimately become, you know, famous and, like, wealthy and powerful in influence, but not so powerful in terms of, like, he's not looking to dominate the species. He's looking to have the ear of powerful men.
Yeah, because he wants to do what he believes is right.
Right, exactly.
And, like, not on the level that Thanos is like, oh, I think what's right is that half of the universe should be gone. He's just like, I think that I have a good idea for how to, like, make the world better.
This is a weird time to do this, 13 yeah. minutes in, but I realize, so, you know, obviously people listening, we've announced up front that this is a spoiler cast, but, you know, so assuming everybody's seen it, but just the real quick, like, the run through of, like, we haven't really talked about just, like, the beats of the movie.
Sure.
Do we want to do, like, so the quick and dirty summary is that it, you know, in the aftermath of Endgame, where there is a, I guess it was an extinction level threat that was realized and then undone in Endgame, we pick back up with the cast from Homecoming. They are students who they are. It's largely Peter's class who mostly was all they refer to as blipped, you know, disappeared
and if I may
by the snap.
If I may interject quickly, they do an opening video that they reveal as, like, the school newscast. That is one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
It might be the best scene in the whole movie. It's a great opener.
I've such an inside baseball joke as showing an image with a Getty Images watermark is the funniest thing I've seen in an MCU movie.
It's great. It's really, really funny. So in the aftermath, Peter's class is going on a class trip to Europe. It's like for summer vacation. And we open with, you know, Peter thinking that since they've just, defeated Thanos and, you know, he basically, it's like he thinks there probably won't be a threat and he deserves a little bit of a break. Mm-hmm. So he's planning to go to Europe. He wants to tell the girl he likes, MJ, how he feels. And in the midst of that, there are these elemental monsters attacking cities around the globe. And a new hero emerges, Quentin Beck, who the kids and media dub Mysterio, because he's mysterious. And that's played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who kind of plays this like fun uncle, Tony Stark, you know, like figure, as Ryan mentioned, up to the pretty much like midpoint of the movie where there is a scene we mentioned in a bar, which I want to talk more about that scene, where it's revealed there's a turn. It's revealed that Mysterio is, in fact, like we knew from the comics, a villain, and that Jake Gyllenhaal has this plan, and all of the elemental monsters have been, you know, illusory. And it's then up to, you know, as Peter learns this, it's up to him to stop Mysterio. And this, the back half of the movie is like finding ways to do that, tracking down Mysterio and overcoming the sort of illusory, like kind of impossible to defeat, you know,
well, it's also,
version of this
also,
villain.
There's also kind of a subtle theme also, which I'm a little surprised they didn't state harder, but I guess they just outright say it. Peter in this movie, he's kind of lost his sixth sense. Like he's vying to get it back. And so I think that's a large part of the movie, is he's trying to get, as they put it, his Peter tingle back.
The term they're using for a spidey sense.
It is weird.
Purists out there.
Are we to assume, is it sort of the sort of guilt, sadness, remorse, whatever, like the events of Endgame, the loss of Tony Stark, is that what we think is affecting it? Or do we think it's more just like he's a hormonal teen boy and like doesn't necessarily have like control over all the like new powers that he's experiencing?
I think it has to do with the idea that he's obviously a little bit in mourning from the death of Tony, or a lot of bit in mourning, but it's also that he's trying to, you know, what I really love about this movie is that it has the classic Spider-Man dilemma, which is that every time that he needs to be Spider-Man, he is sacrificing a part of his own life to do it. And that's the hard thing for him of being Spider-Man. So I think that it's, you know, over and over again in this movie, he's kind of like, I don't want to be Spider-Man on this trip. I'm just taking a break. Like, I just want to be like a kid and enjoy this time and talk to the girl that I like and all those things. So it's that he's like preoccupied, but also like trying to kind of shut it out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not fully in.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, he's not completely there.
I think Spider-Man, more than probably almost any other character in the Marvel Universe, has such direct needs, and there's such like such blatant obstacles to his needs that makes for such great tension in any Spider-Man movie. Like, he wants so hard just to be a normal guy and to tell the woman that he loves her, but he can't do it every single time because he's Spider-Man. And I think Spider-Man just lends itself to this amazing ability where no matter like however right things get close to like it almost working, they always never work. Like, that is such a Spider-Man like trope, and they play it beautifully.
It's the classic Parker luck.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it's what, honestly, I think it's what makes it, for to say something so like tropey, but like, it's what makes the character so enduring. You know, it's like the universal thing. It's he wants to do what's right, and that's what makes it hard.
Right.
Great power comes great responsibility.
He has the responsibility.
And as far, I mean, well, I want to also cite, there's a lot of actually I'm finding I want to talk about with this movie. It's like that relationship. I think it's actually it's an interesting time to be, you know, writing, you know, a Peter MJ love story. And I will say that, like, I found myself super invested.
Yes.
And I found myself, like, very, sort of, you know, nostalgic to, like, the simplicity of high school love and emotions and everything. And I also think they really threaded a difficult needle in terms of, you know, this is, The movie's called Spider-Man. It's about, you know, the archetypical straight white male hero and it's his story. And that's who people are, you know, paying to go see. And it would be very easy to do the thing that everyone has ever done with the Spider-Man stories, and have, you know, the love interest be the damsel in distress that he has to save from falling, that he has to catch, that he has to choose between, you know, right, rescuing her or someone else. And
yeah,
they really, really did a good job with Zendaya's mm-hmm. MJ of making her not only her own character and mm-hmm. and motivated in her own way. And while it doesn't fully, you know, it never becomes her movie, she's not right, quite as much of a protagonist as Peter ever, but like, they don't sideline her and they don't make her, you know, I already said it, damsel in distress, right, which I really like.
No, they do a really good job. I think all of the characters, they actually do a good job of not making them so oblivious to what's happening, which I think is really easy to fall into, especially for a love interest character or a potential love interest character. Like, it almost like dumbs them down. Like, if Zendaya's MJ was just like, she just kind of reveals that, like, yeah, I'm pretty sure you're Spider-Man because all of these things happen, you're here. Like I feel like maybe 10, 20 years ago, they would not have done that with that character. They wouldn't have, like, dared to give them that kind of knowledge or actually pretended that they were participating in the world. Whereas they're usually kind of almost like a kind of a side or like a set piece. You know what I mean?
Well, and they also, yes, I do. I agree. And I think they also give her own full character.
Yeah,
that's
right.
You know, I mean, she's surprised when she learns that she's right mm-hmm. with her prediction that he's Spider-Man.
Right.
That was such a good scene.
You know, she has her own, she has her own as a supporting character, you know, she has her own like quirks and yep. interests and yeah. fascinations. And I think that, so we all saw this, with wives and girlfriends. And I was like, you know, I was happy that like, that her character was handled well and that it was like actually a good romantic storyline. And between her and Tom Holland, they are so magnetic and charismatic.
Oh my God. Right.
I was like, I feel it.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Want these two to figure it out.
If I may, Zendaya, I'm not sure. I don't know exactly which one it is. I've heard it both ways. But Zendaya is like a piece of the sun just like dropped onto Earth. She is like so magnetic. Yeah. She's so charismatic. This like interpretation of this character, I am over the moon for.
You'd have never seen it coming. If you've ever read any Spider-Man or watched any Spider-Man, you would never have predicted this MJ. And no. It's such a ray of light. It's so good.
Yeah. And they play their age too, which is like,
yes,
I really hard for a Hollywood movie to have grips with. Like, so often they try to play young people as just basically versions of adults, and it's so off-putting half the time. And I think the fact that they play these characters to their age, like his buddy,
mm-hmm.
I think it's perfect.
There's also like it was realistic to perhaps my experience, which mm-hmm. we'll see, but like, before the big kiss at the end, you know, when they're like standing on the bridge,
mm-hmm.
he gives her like the smallest kiss,
mm-hmm.
you know,
like a peck.
It's like very quick. Like he's just like, you know, it's so sweet because it's like, yeah, when you're that age, that is the biggest deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a giant movie kiss. And although they end up kind of having that.
Right.
But before that, it's like, that's enough. Like that's all like.
You think
that's
about,
more than he could have ever asked for.
Right, and it's hilarious.
Or her, too, because she likes him so much. It's like they both... Yeah. There's like this mutual thing of like they both like each other. Yep. It doesn't feel like this imbalance where he's like pursuing her.
Right.
And she's like, you know, it doesn't have that like usual tropey kind of like gender dynamic.
He has to win her over or anything.
Yeah, no, it's like they both like each other. They're both people who are like intelligent and like... And
it makes it, you know, so like that kind of subtlety makes it so like important in the movie, especially when like Peter's been to space and he's nervous. Yeah. He's nervous about MJ. So it's like,
well,
it makes it the waiting so perfect.
And it's like he wants to do on the trip, like his intentions are that he's like, we're going to get together and I'm going to tell her how I feel. And it's like, when you're that age, that is the hardest thing in the world. You know, he's not he's like you said, he's been to space, but it's like the thing he's right. afraid of.
Right. It's like everybody
is that it won't be a perfect
and everybody can kind of relate to like that field trip time. Like you're out of school, you get a little bit of independence. So then that's like that is the kind of like the high school thing when you're on a high school field trip. Those are the moments, those are the scenarios that you do.
Yeah, you have, and like Ned and his girlfriend have that like they have their field trip relationship.
Yeah. It was really the John Watts and I don't remember the screenwriters' names. Do you know who wrote this? Does this have a set of screenwriters?
I think it was two people.
It wasn't the same as the as who wrote Homecoming.
The six.
I mean, they have such a deft, you know, hand and such a good feel for just like that actual like the actual like young person teenage experience that it does feel really really good.
The writers are Eric Summers and Chris McKenna.
Okay. Did the guy
who were writers on the first one?
Gotcha. What?
But Chris, also there was another one on that.
What did Chris McKenna do?
Chris McKenna is a writer on Community, the Mindy Project.
Yes.
Lego Batman movie.
Yep.
So I see that Ant-Man and the Wasp as well.
Mm-hmm.
The new Jumanji.
So,
and then,
outside of the writer's credits, let's talk. I still want to dive in a little deeper on that scene in the middle, that bar scene.
Sure.
Yes.
Because I think this whole movie, ultimately how I'm going to feel about it and how I think people probably feel about it, it's like it has to hinge on that scene, like how much you buy into that scene. And I think like if this is the one problem I have with this movie is like structurally, I think it puts way, way, way too much on a single scene in the middle for that turn. Now, I guess I would assume if you're into a spoiler podcast about Far From Home, you're not going to worry about spoilers from Homecoming. So I'm about to send a spoiler for that. But the big reveal in Homecoming about Michael Keaton's identity, when you realize, who he is, and that he's the villain that Peter's been facing. For me, that scene works because it's like, it's a surprise and it's purely additive. You know, it's simply what it does is it heightens all of the, like all of the obstacles that Peter's facing in the movie. Whereas I think this movie, Far From Home, the turn where Jake Gyllenhaal reveals not only that he's the villain, but his villainous plot and his villainous motivations all in one scene. I'm interested on rewatch, how this changes, but it's putting too much on it, and it immediately follows that you have to buy, and this is the part that was hardest for me, that Peter Parker would give away the only item he had left from Tony Stark to someone he met, just days ago. And they try and cover it by like it's too much responsibility that he's trying to eschew. But I don't know if at all it was just so much on one scene that I had to like agree to. Did it all work for you guys, or?
It worked for me. I thought it was a little long. Like I thought they went through a few too many people, but like that's something that I can like get over. Yeah. But to be honest, yes, it did work for me. I think that they established Peter's kind of like naivete and like kind of this desire to subliminally or not to be free of like the burden. You know, I don't think he was trying to shirk responsibility, but I think that when he met Quentin Beck, he felt relieved. Because there was like someone else who could kind of fill those shoes. So I think he had this subconscious desire to want to be free of that.
Yeah.
He
got tricked on a level that Mysterio didn't even know he was actually tricking him at the beginning. Because he didn't realize Parker had those trepidations. Like, I think I'll meet in the middle here. I think it was, I don't know how else you would reveal that because he's just some guy. I think to have the whole like crew there with them, that's a little like, okay, like I get it. It's like your road crew to put on the show. I would have liked maybe a little more foreshadowing or something that I could have looked back to say, that made more sense. Like that's why he did that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think it would have enhanced that scene if you had something that was a little ambiguous previous to it. But I do think it was also a little long-winded. But at the end of the day, it's like, okay, well, now that we know this, let's see what cool things we can do with it. Mm-hmm. And they, I think by the ending, when we get those, the crazy, just like, I don't even know how you would describe them to other people. Just like the animations, the mirages
that he was setting. Oh, it
was so good. I think that was, it's worth the payoff to have that slow scene just basically explain what's going on. Because there is a lot of buy-in there also.
I do think, yeah, and I think, the length of the scene, I thought they were like, yeah, so he goes through a list of examples of like people. It's essentially a team of people wronged by Tony Stark, or who feel they were wronged by Tony Stark, banded together under Quentin Beck for this, you know, sort of Mysterio New World Order, you know, get theirs. And he goes through a lot of them, which I agree is too long. But like
he goes through like four and he could have done two.
The length of the scene doesn't bother me. It's honestly, it's just how much weight is put on it and how weird it kind of feels that it really does to me, like, just like bifurcate the movie. Like, you have the first half and the second half, and then in the middle there's this scene that's almost a play in a bar, you know?
Yeah.
But what I'll say positively, I mean, Gyllenhaal, I think I like the length of the scene only because we get all that performance from him.
Yeah.
Like, he's very, very good. And then I love what comes next, because so the way they, you know, and I think everybody knows this, but like, you know, the way they handle Mysterio's sort of power set, his illusion, you know, magic that he uses in the comics, which is all special effects oriented. This, he has, you know, a series of drones, and he gets more drones by getting control of, you know, Stark Tech. And he can program them to project not only, you know, his persona and character and powers, but the villains he's fighting, and he can use them to like affect the environment. And I think it does, like, I loved that in the final act, you know, of the movie, we're seeing, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal in a, like, a mocap suit with a fishbowl on his head that he's using to like communicate and control and contact these people, and he's essentially, you know, directing or project managing or producing this fake event.
Right. It was neat to see the kind of the puppet wires at play. I'm glad
it was very, very cool. And I think I like the turn, the truly villainous turn that he takes right at the end. Well, sorry, there's two villainous turns, right? But the one that I'm speaking to is like he attempts to murder Peter.
Right.
In cold blood.
Yeah, and he's a bad guy.
It's a really chilling look at a villain who's like ready and willing to kill a 16-year-old or 17-year-old.
Yeah. I think it's definitely the mirage, the idea, the concept of Spider-Man, basically, to get his powers back, he has to figure out what's real or what's fake. And I think that it's like the ultimate metaphor for the movie. He has to know what's real to him versus what is not real. And I think there's a lot of that when you're growing up. You don't know what's a reality you need to face versus something you don't need to face. And I think that the movie, it plays on that strength. And by the end, when you have him relying on his senses, like, I think I was trying to like lock down the kind of the political message of this movie, if there is one for young people, where it's like, it's kind of like, don't believe the perception. But then also, I was kind of wrestling with it, because I was like, is it saying fake news? The news is fake? Like,
I think there was definitely kind of like a fake news, like, element to it. And like, hey, don't believe all the propaganda and all, like, don't believe the loudest voice in the room necessarily.
Yeah. Like, all of the this lights in this show, it's like, it's like, Peter knows, like, in his bones, like, what is
exactly
real.
Exactly.
And
go ahead, sorry.
I was just gonna say, and I think that's kind of the message here, is that it's like, you have that feeling when something's right or not right, and it's your responsibility to act on it or not.
And but speaking to that moment, you know, like, almost every Spider-Man movie has had this kind of climactic moment where there's a confluence of, like, Peter's abilities, or and also Miles in Spider-Verse, in Spider-Man's abilities and like his will, You know, so there's a theme of there being a tie-in between his abilities and kind of his emotional state, right? So if you look at Raimi's Spider-Man 2, he loses his abilities because his heart is not in it. He's kind of doubting being Spider-Man. An Amazing Spider-Man 1, he has the moment with the cranes where he's kind of beaten down, and then he needs to push forward. An Amazing Spider-Man 2, he has the moment where he has to figure out how to beat Electro with the webs and things like that. Far From Home, in Homecoming, he has the moment where he's stuck under the rubble, mm-hmm. and he's scared, and he has to kind of like persevere. And then in Spider-Verse, it's the moment where Miles doesn't feel like he can control his abilities, and then you know, there's that amazing sequence where he kind of like focuses and is able to do it. And in this, barring Spider-Verse, I think in terms of live-action Spider-Man movies, Peter closing his eyes and using his spider sense to defeat Mysterio, I think, is the best example of that.
Yep. Yeah.
I think that from a pure visceral standpoint, I think that they nailed the movement of Spider-Man, that whole sequence with the drones. Mm-hmm. And I think that they really, there was a great emotional build to that moment that was insanely satisfying. And the visuals are amazing because it's mixing in, you know, the illusions with like him breaking the drones and then the illusions breaking down in this kind of like compartmental way.
It's so crazy because you think about it, like if that was an action shot without the illusions on it, it would still be impressive of him running around with his eyes closed, smashing all these drones. And the fact that they're having an illusion floating through the scene, like I can't even begin to know how somebody directed that or described it. I think it's, they probably just like messed around with stuff and they're like, all right, we got it.
And
it is very cool. And like, I think the action sequences in this movie, the web swinging and the actual like confrontations with Mysterio are like up there with my favorites. I did say, like, the immediate reaction after the movie was I did feel it was a little bit derivative of some stuff we've seen lately of, like, you know, fantasy, spiritual, like, ghost or, like, force realm moments. But
A little Luke Skywalker-ish.
Having said that, and moving past that, it is such a perfect way to handle this villain. And, the two things that were, I mean, both times Mysterio, Quentin Beck, like, went full villain both times, like shocked and like kind of disgusted me. Like at one point he's using illusions and scaring Peter Parker so bad that he walks onto train tracks in front of an oncoming train and he's hit by a train. And then another time he goes to shoot him in the head and Spider-Man, you know, his Peter Tingle, you know, warns him and he's able to stop and, you know, dodge that attack. But it's like truly chilling, villainous stuff. And it's like, it is really, really affecting, I think.
Yeah.
Just to, I guess, outright spoil the two, for me, most like exciting moments of the movie.
Yeah. Does, is there a third one planned?
I think so.
I'm sure they'll do it.
Yeah.
No,
what
I heard, and this was, I mean, nobody's revealed like the full on extent of the deal with Sony, but I remembered reading that the Disney Sony partnership would work for like, you know, team up movies and two solo films. So I don't know if they have to revisit the partnership or if that was like erroneous.
Not to keep going. There'd be no reason.
It's so much
they
fun.
Would.
Especially since this is a handshake deal. No one's making money off of the other
one. I would love to see them play off the Spider-Verse that they've established and seriously start introducing all of the Spider-Men into one kind of world. Like, I would love if they had a Tobey Maguire cameo.
Oh my god.
Can you imagine?
I'm saying that, I'm not saying that like, oh my god. I'm saying that like, oh my god.
Right?
I don't agree with you.
What? I don't agree with you either. I think Spider-Verse, I think there is something a little different. I don't know if this is a popular opinion, but I think there's something different doing it animated, and I think it worked so amazingly that, like, I completely buy the whole interdimensional, transdimensional thing going on where there's, like, different Spider-Men from different universes and everything. I don't know that it would work as well for me in live action.
Right.
Plus, there wasn't...
You're both
Spider-Verse didn't have,
you're both,
like... baggage.
You were both pretty upset when Jameson
loved
showed
it. Loved that.
It was great.
Because for so long, everyone, even, you know, through the Mark Webb ones and then this one, everyone was like, you can never show J. Jonah Jameson again because how are they going to beat him? And it's like, it just seems so inevitable. It's of course, they should just get him again.
Yeah, I love...
who's stopping them?
I love that they have him for the dailybugle.net, and he's trying to do a...
He's like an Alex Jones type.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought the way they set up, you know, because it's a huge thing in the Spider-Man, you know, mythology that, you know, that the cops and New York think Spider-Man is a villain. He's like constantly fighting against that, feeding more into what a great character he is, that like he continues doing the right thing, even though everyone hates him for it. And I think that the way they set that up is great. My real hope for the third one, if there is one, which of course there will be, is that I finally want to see like the New York Spider-Man MCU movie. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope that they can kind of get him out from under the shadow of.
Yeah.
Obviously he's tied into the MCU. I'd love to see him get a little bit more of a solo movie. Sure. I don't need so much Tony. I don't need all that.
First movie we saw Spider-Man, literally Far From Home. First one he was out of New York.
I like what they've done most of the time. I feel like they're trying to subvert the Spider-Man kind of, because we've seen it so many times.
Exactly.
And I'm hoping for the third one that they really go straight into it, and we get, you know, the ultimate kind of the ultimate Spider-Man.
I think that would be super cool. I've really liked what they've done. I think I'm definitely ready for them to move on from the Tony Stark connect. I mean, like, he was all over Home. I mean, he was literally in Homecoming. You know, he was like in so much of that movie, even though, you know, Robert Downey Jr. was in like 2 days of shooting for that movie. But like, you know, Iron Man was a big presence in that movie, and he was obviously, he cast a big shadow on this one.
Gwyneth Paltrow didn't even know she was in it.
That's true.
She also hasn't seen Endgame. I don't think Gwyneth Paltrow is really plugged into the MCU.
It's all right.
Well, you know, it's exciting. It's exciting. That was a very exciting post-credit or mid-credit sequence that they had there.
It was definitely a surprise.
It was great, and I'm really I thought it left it on a very exciting note, and I think that I hope they get John Watts again. I think that the cast they have is great. So,
do you think Mysterio just did that to be a jerk? Because so what we're talking about is in the first you know stinger, they reveal like live in Times Square that
Madison
like Quentin
Square
Back
Garden.
Hit. What's that?
It's Madison Square Garden. It's on the side.
Oh,
of
is it
Square Garden?
Thank you. Thank you for the correction.
Sure.
That was.
Sure.
I'm glad everyone now.
I didn't want to get
wrong.
I didn't want you to get raked over the coals.
Oh yeah, all right. Yeah, don't write in. Ryan's got my back. But like he blows Spider-Man's cover. He reveals that it's Peter Parker, and they show his picture. And like, what was? Why did he do that? Just to be mean? Just because he screwed up his plan?
Yeah, I think so. He's
a
villain.
Well, man, he's a real vile villain.
Yes, sir.
We'll find out in The Amazing Spider-Man Part 3: Tobey Maguire's Revenge.
Oh, God. Well, thank
home
you for joining us on The Outpost, for talking about Spider-Man Far From Home. We're having a great time doing these, so we'll be doing them as they come up. Maybe we'll... Chris and I saw Midsummer the other day.
Ooh.
Maybe we'll do a Midsummer
Ooh,
Outpost.
I like that, yeah. A little far out. I like it.
Please join us on Fridays for our mainline episodes. Anything else you guys want
to
add?
Don't forget to follow the Droids Pod, at Droids Pod at Twitter. What is it? droidspod@gmail.com for email. Facebook, the Droids Pod. Just search the Droids Podcast. My Instagram at Droids Pod. This is the worst one of these I've ever done. And
bring it home, baby.
You can get us wherever podcasts are consumed, downloaded, listened to. Stitcher,
and
iTunes.
Your local brick and mortar.
And please, if you like this, the episode of The Outpost, or if you like the other podcast, please rate this podcast, like us, tell a friend, more importantly. We love that. Share your favorite moments if you've seen Spider-Man Far From Home. Please send us your thoughts. We'll love to read them in a future episode of The Outpost. And that being said, hey, Ryan, do you know what I like to do?
What do you like to do, Chris?
For people listening, and Sam, sorry, Sam. Ryan had thrown to me. That's why I was throwing it back. For people listening, if you are listening to this point, guess what? I'm going to say a secret word. That secret word is tingle. The secret word is tingle. And if you write us an email with the secret word tingle, you can win your very own The Simpsons poster. I'll get some more details on that in the description. But yes, secret word is tingle. And the secret word from before, I don't think anybody won, cloud. So either of those words will put you in the running for a for a few nice posters.
Any word.
Literally just email us and the posters are yours. All right. I think that about does it, guys.
That's right. Nice, thank you for nice tight closer by Chris.
Thank you for joining us on the Outpost. Mike, we hope you're back from your assignment that J. Jonah Jameson didn't give you too hard of a time. Until next time, I'm Ryan. For Sam and Chris, I'm Ryan with the Outpost.
Oh, Chris, he so obviously threw that to you for your poster thing.